All right, good morning and welcome everybody to Bio 241. And it's March 22nd, the last lecture this week. And we got one more week before spring break next week. And what about an exam? Do we have an exam next week? Let's take a look at the schedule right here. Okay, so here's spring break. The next exam is going to be on April 12th, which is the week immediately after spring break. But not on Tuesday, it's going to be on Thursday. Right, and then the last exam during the regular semester is going to be on a Tuesday. That's going to be in May 8th. All right, so the next exam on April 12th, a Thursday, and it's chapters 9, 10, and 11, and we're kind of right in the middle of that material for that next exam. All right, does anybody have any questions over autonomic nervous system? No? Okay, what is, how would you describe the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic? Usually antagonistic to each other. All right, let's view an example of how it's not exactly antagonistic under some circumstances. So for instance, here we have what is this right here? Yeah, nice heart. All right, isn't anatomy easy? All right, so here we have the two atria, right? Here we have the two ventricles. Of these chambers, of the atria and ventricles, which one pumps the blood the most, with the most pressure, with the most force? Is it the atria or the ventricles? Yeah, it's the ventricles, and somebody said left ventricle, and you're exactly right because that goes through the systemic circulation. All right, so the atria hardly pump at all, but the ventricles pump a lot. What controls the heart? What controls the heart rate? You actually kind of talked about this in the first lab, but there's a pacemaker in the heart. We're going to spend a whole chapter looking at it, but this is just to review a little bit. Yeah, it's the SA node, which is about right here, the SA node, that regulates the heart rate. And remember, last time we talked about two ways we think about when the heart is working. One is in terms of rate, and the other is in terms of force of contraction. What did we call those two things? Inotropy versus chronotropy. All right, so as a matter of fact, let's put chronotropy first. And let's put inotropy second. All right, chronotropy has to do with adjusting the heart rate. Inotropy has to do with adjusting strength of contraction or myocardial contractility. Sometimes we talk about it that way. But how about force of contraction? All right, and these are regulated in different ways. And what are the two ways? The two ways. Let's see. Maybe I have a blue marker right here. And let's use, how many different divisions are there in the autonomic nervous system? There are two. And what are they? Number one is, all right, I'm just saying parasympathetic first. It's just arbitrary. Parasympathetic. And then that means that the second is going to be sympathetic. Sympathetic. All right, I'm thinking about how I want to make this diagram. All right, so the parasympathetic. Oh, I know what I wanted to do. That's why I got this blue marker right here. Let's do parasympathetic in blue. Let's see if I can figure this out. Ah, that's not very good. Maybe I can't do it in blue. I'm going to try to do it in blue. Can you see that at all in the back?
No.
Not at all. Okay, forget it. It's going to be black and black. Parasympathetic. All right, so those are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. And the parasympathetic nerves, and you should probably know which one that is, goes to the atrium, and in particular the sinoatrial node, right? So it can affect that part of the heart, okay? And so what is that going to affect? The chronotropy or the inotropy of the heart if it's going to the sinoatrial node? Okay, it's going to adjust the rate of the heart, right? So this is going to be
Oh, that looks like red, huh?
Okay, so I'm going to put a number one right here. Parasympathetic is going to adjust the heart rate. And in which way is it going to adjust the heart rate? It's going to slow the heart rate down. So it's a negative chronotropic agent. So that will slow the heart down. I'll put a decreasing arrow right here. And that's the only place where the parasympathetics go, to the heart, only to the atria. Now, what about the sympathetic nervous system? Where do nerves go to the heart for the sympathetic nervous system? Number one, it goes to the SA node. And what's the effect on the SA node? It's going to speed up the rate. So I'm going to put an up arrow right here. And we see the parasympathetics are down arrow. So what's that relationship? That's a nice antagonistic relationship in terms of controlling heart rate. So parasympathetic slows the heart down, sympathetic speeds it up. Now here's one last interesting thing. Sympathetics also go to the ventricles of the heart. And when norepinephrine is released on the ventricles of the heart, it increases the force of contraction. What's the term we use for force of contraction? Inotropy. So the sympathetic nervous system goes to the ventricles to increase the force of contraction as well. So I'm going to put another up arrow right here. Sorry, I got the colors all mixed up. But anyway, that's okay. So the parasympathetics can only adjust chronotropy, but not inotropy of the heart. So in terms of inotropy, there's no antagonistic relationship between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system because the parasympathetic nervous system doesn't even go to the ventricles to affect the force of contraction or the inotropy of the heart. In terms of chronotropy, parasympathetic and sympathetic are antagonistic, but not in terms of inotropy, which is sort of interesting. Okay, so that's the last thing I wanted to say. It shows that in that table of effects that are in that that particular chapter, but I forgot to mention it during the last lecture. So why is it that the parasympathetic nervous system can't affect the force of contraction on the heart, on the myocardium? Because there are no nerves that go there from the parasympathetic nervous system. And what is the nerve that goes to the heart that's parasympathetic? Maybe I asked you, right? Did I ask you today already? Okay, it's vagus nerve. What cranial nerve is vagus nerve? Number 10, right. All right, so that's the last little bit for the autonomic nervous system. Usually they're antagonistic, but here's an interesting exception to that rule in terms of inotropy on the heart. All right, so we're going to start talking about sensory physiology today. I think you've had a couple labs already with sensory physiology. We might go over some of the things that are in lab, but maybe some of the things will be different as well. All right, so what the heck is a sensory receptor? It allows you to communicate with your internal environment and also the external environment. And the job of a receptor is to accept some kind of energy signal, and it could be light energy, could be sound energy, could be chemical molecules. Right, and it's going to change the magnitude of that energy into something else that your brain can understand. And your brain understands the electrical signals only. It doesn't really understand light or salt concentration. And so what is the language that your brain speaks in terms of electrical energy? It is action potentials, right? So a receptor is something that will change one modality of energy like light into that form of energy that your brain can understand, which is an action potential. So it changes environmental stimulus into, so it changes some environmental energy into action potentials, which is the language that your brain can understand. And so we call that signal transduction, when it changes form. Right, from whatever that energy is, light energy into action potentials, that's what we call transduction. And that's what receptors do. They transduce one form of energy into another. And each kind of receptor responds to a particular modality or form of energy, right, like sound, light, pressure, for instance. And different modalities are perceived different in your consciousness because action potentials from different receptors go to different parts of the brain. And if that part of the brain receives an action potential, whether or not there is a proper stimulus or not, that's what you will perceive in your reality. So for instance, if anybody know where the visual cortex is? What part of the brain is responsible for vision? Occipital lobe, probably kind of know that from anatomy. So that if we artificially stimulate the occipital lobe, maybe with some electrodes, guess what your perception will be? You'll see something. You'll have like an experience of seeing something. Of course, it won't make sense, but you'll see something. Okay. And so different parts of the brain just give you a different sense of different modalities, depending on where it is. Like, for instance, the primary auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe, much different than the occipital lobe. All right, so sensory receptors can be simple dendritic endings, like I see wrapping around this hair follicle right here. So whenever the hair follicle moves, that causes depolarizations in these nerve endings right here, and then you'll get the sense that something's brushing up against your skin or moving these hair follicles around, maybe a breeze or whatever. There are other free nerve endings that are in the dermis. Those are temperature nerve endings, so you can experience hot and cold, different nerve endings for each one of those. Or if they get bruised or cut or lacerated, you can have a sense of pain. Right, so those are free nerve endings. Or receptors can be kind of fancy structures, like we see this Pacinian corpuscle right here. So these are specialized endings of neurons that when they're stimulated, for instance, when they're depressed, that causes sodium channels to open. Right, and when a sodium channel opens in this neuron right here, what happens? That's an excitation of that particular neuron. If it reaches threshold, then an action potential will be sent to the brain. All right, so here I see some specialized nerve endings. We can also characterize receptors by the kinds of stimulus that they transduce. So here's a bunch of different kinds of stimuli. There are chemoreceptors that can sense the concentration of chemicals inside your body. Like there are glucoreceptors in the pancreas. All right, there are hydrogen ion receptors in the brain. And what are those hydrogen ion receptors in the brain? What are they really measuring in terms of our scientific language that we use? Yeah, pH. They can measure pH of your body. All right, photoreceptors can transduce light, can change light into action potentials, and those action potentials then are sent to the brain. Where are those located at? Eyes, only in your eyes. Mechanoreceptors respond to deformation of the cell membrane by depolarization, like those Pacinian corpuscles and Meissner's corpuscles. Nociceptors respond to intense stimuli signaling pain. And these are usually free nerve endings in your skin, okay, or maybe in your nasal passageways and lungs. And then here's something called a proprioceptor. Proprioception are receptors that we find in muscles and joints primarily, and they can monitor and measure the amount of stretch that a muscle is going through or the position of a joint. And these are important for your body to unconsciously maintain body position. And where do you have muscles? In one location in your body or all over the place? All over the place. All right, what about joints? One or two locations or all over the place? All over the place, right? So some of these senses right here are what we call general and some we call special. If you have receptors all over the body, like you do for pain, for instance, and pressure and temperature, right? That's what we call a general sense. So if I take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, could you tell that that's a cold ice cube? Yeah. If I put it on your kneecap, could you tell it's cold? Or your belly button, or wherever I put it, you could tell that it's cold, right? So that's a general sense. All right, but if I take a flashlight and I shine it in your belly button, can you see it? No. Because it's not a general sense, it's what we call a special sense. So special senses have organs that are located in one or maybe two locations, because you have two eyes, right, that can transduce that particular modality of energy. So that's the big difference. So proprioception right here seems like it's a really special sense. It's got a really fancy word, but is it a general or a special sense? It's a general sense because you have those receptors all over the body, not just in one location like you do for vision, like you do for taste and smell. okay, and hearing, for instance, right? So proprioception is still a general sense. So your book kind of just classifies general and cutaneous as being the same. That's really not how I think about it. General means you have receptors all over the body. If it's a special sense, then you can sense that modality of energy just in one or two locations. All right, so cutaneous and general maybe are not exactly the same in the way that I'm thinking. But cutaneous just means on your skin, okay? But, of course, the proprioceptors you have in joints and muscles, those aren't really in your skin, but they're still general sensors. Okay, so that's a big difference. So we're going to look at some of those different kinds of sensory apparatuses. All right, we can also classify how a stimulus is appreciated. All right, some are appreciated through tonic receptors and some through phasic receptors. All right, and let's look at this diagram right here. If we have a tonic receptor and we apply a stimulus and we keep that stimulus on for a constant amplitude for a certain period of time, say a long period of time, and then turn the stimulus off, all right, that receptor is going to produce action potentials. And what can you tell me about the amplitude of these action potentials from when we turn the stimulus on compared to when we turn it off? That's right, because an action potential is always going to be the same amplitude. What about the duration? It's going to be the same. What about the distance between these action potentials, which we consider what the frequency of action potentials moving down a neuron? Okay, for a tonic receptor, right, the frequency is going to be the same as well. So if we turn the stimulus on, we will have an appreciation of whatever that stimulus is, right? And it won't fade away over time. We'll have a constant appreciation of what that stimulus is. We call this slow adapting due to a tonic receptor. But that's not always the case, right? We have some receptors, right, that are fast adapting. For instance, some of those would be smell and touch. Like right now, you don't feel that you're wearing any clothes, but when you first put some clothes on, like your shoes or socks in the morning, certainly you could feel your feet putting a sock on, but right now that's really not rising to the level of your consciousness because those are phasic receptors. So if we look at the second diagram right here, if we apply a stimulus, right, and keep the stimulus on for the same period of time as the first case and the same amplitude, notice what happens to the action potentials that are being produced by that particular receptor. Right? What about the amplitude? Exactly the same. The duration of an action potential? Exactly the same. But there is something changing, and that is the distance between action potentials and time, which we consider what? The frequency of action potentials? What happens to the frequency of action potentials with a phasic receptor? It decreases over time. All right, and so then what does your brain or cerebral cortex think when the frequency of action potential decreases? It thinks that the amplitude of the stimulus is decreasing when that happens, right? All right, so that's what we call a fast adapting kind of receptor, and then you just lose the perception of whatever that stimulus is because the frequency of action potentials is dying away. All right, and that's not because the neuron gets fatigued, it's because of the receptor itself is changing. Okay, some good examples would be touch and smell. For instance, if you walk into a library pretty much anywhere in the world, it's going to smell like a library, like a book, right? When you first walk in the door, go, oh, here, even if you were blindfolded and I took you into a library, you could tell. But after 5 minutes, okay, you can't tell anymore because your nose has adapted, and those are the receptors that are adapting. All right, so that's the big difference between tonic and phasic receptors. Let's talk about the law of specific nerve energies. All right, and it says that stimulation of a sensory fiber evokes only the sensation of that particular modality because those action potentials go to a particular part of the brain. So action potentials that are developed from an olfactory or smelling apparatus are exactly like the action potentials developed by Bacinian corpuscles, which are for touch, which are exactly the same action potentials that the eye develops, right? So action potentials are always the same. The only thing that's different is what part of the brain those action potentials go to. Okay, and then here's the concept of adequate stimulus. This is the normal stimulus that a receptor will perceive, and then generate action potentials and send to the brain. And an adequate stimulus is just the kind of stimulus that requires the least amount of energy to activate that particular receptor. All right, so a pretty good example of this is, what is an eyeball good for? What kind of signal, what kind of stimulus is an eyeball good for transducing into action potentials? Light, okay? So, yeah, we see light that gets changed into action potentials, but have you ever hit your head by accident? Okay, do you ever see stars? Maybe you hit your face. All right, so if we pressurize an eyeball, okay, or get hit in the head with a baseball, softball, basketball, volleyball, any of that kind of stuff, right, badminton birdie, all right, you'll see like a flash of light because that pressure on your eye has stimulated those photoreceptors to produce action potentials that go to the occipital lobe, and then you have that sensation of vision. It's inappropriate, right, because it's pressure that's producing it, but... Okay, that pressure is not the adequate stimulus because it requires a great amount of pressure to get those photoreceptors to generate action potentials. All right, so it's not only light that can stimulate your eye into producing action potentials, but light is what the most efficient kind of energy that will do that. All right, so and so because it's the most efficient, then we call that the adequate stimulus. Okay, so here you see some receptors and the normal adequate stimulus for what those receptors are in this table, table 10.1. All right, so how does that happen? Here we see a graph of membrane potential kind of versus time, and we see some little gold lines or yellow lines right here, right? These are what we call generator potentials that are produced by a receptor, right? So when a receptor... has applied to it the adequate stimulus, it's going to produce these generator potentials. And what's a really nice way of thinking of these generator potentials? Okay, these are like graded potentials, right? So they can be different in height depending on the amplitude of the stimulus. Remember, so a graded potential can change amplitude depending on the nature of the stimulus. Right, the amplitude of the stimulus and how long it's applied for. But for receptor cells, we call these generator potentials. They're really the same thing as postsynaptic potentials. Now, but what kind of postsynaptic? Do these look inhibitory or excitatory? Yeah, these are always excitatory because it's depolarizing the membrane to threshold. So these generator potentials are the equivalents of EPSPs in a part of a cell that normally has ligand-gated channels on it. All right. And if the generator potential reaches threshold, these cells have voltage-gated channels that open up, which then cause this action potential to develop. And this is just like the action potential that you're familiar with what, depolarization, repolarization. And then what else do you have over here? This is pretty important. Hyperpolarization, and that produces a relative refractory period. So that if we come right at this point in time, right here, with a generator potential number 4, will that cause another action potential right at this point in time? It won't because it can't overcome this hyperpolarization. But if we come along with a graded potential of number 4 and number 1 on top of each other, what happens? Indeed, that's a stronger stimulus, and that can produce an action potential because it reaches threshold. So that means that an action potential can follow the first one closer in time, right? And so it will be a higher frequency of action potentials as these generator potentials increase, right? Due to this relative refractory period right here. All right, so these generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. And after a threshold is reached, the action potential frequency is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential via that last discussion that we just had, right? And in phasic receptors, these generator potentials adapt to constant stimulus and then quickly diminish, right, in amplitude. And when they diminish in amplitude, then of course they can't add up to threshold to produce an action potential, right? So a nerve is always going to have the same threshold, always be able to produce an action potential, but when a receptor adapts, it's these generator potentials that actually get lower and lower and lower in amplitude, which then makes it more difficult to create an action potential. Okay, so in tonic receptors, right? Generator potential does not adapt to constant stimulus. So let's look at three examples right here. We got three examples of stimulus, amplitude versus time. We turn it on here, turn it off right over here. So here's the stimulus, and this, I guess you could think of this as being a light signal for the eyes. All right, this kind of stimulus will produce generator potentials, but what kind of generator potential is that if you were to characterize it? Sub-threshold, because it doesn't reach threshold, and if it doesn't reach threshold, it won't produce any action potentials. All right, and this one here, so we increase the stimulus. What happens to the generator potential? Just like an EPSP, it's going to be higher in amplitude. It's going to reach threshold, so it will produce an action potential. All right, but right at this period of time, it's still at threshold, but what's happening to the action potential right here? It's still recovering. It's in that relative refractory period. It's hyperpolarized, so this level of stimulus is no longer at threshold because of hyperpolarization, and so an action potential won't form until way down over here someplace, until that neuron recovers from that relative refractory period. So the frequency of action potentials is relatively slow with this just barely threshold stimulus. But if we turn the stimulus way up, right, and this produces a very large generator potential, now we see that the, of course, the action potentials have the same width, same height, but now they're higher in frequency and time because this supra-threshold stimulus can overcome that relative refractory period produced by that area of hyperpolarization in that neuron. So it has higher action potential frequency, which your brain interprets as what? A higher intensity, right? A greater amplitude of stimulus, which we see right here on this diagram right here. That's the highest amplitude in terms of stimulus. All right, so all receptors kind of behave those rules. All right, let's talk about taste and smell. But we should probably say what the sense of taste is. Anybody know what taste is really called? It's called gustation, and smell is olfaction. All right, and these, and as a matter of fact, we could classify receptors by their location as well. Exteroreceptors respond to chemicals in the environment. Interoceptors respond to chemicals that are inside our body. And let's just say that chemicals that are in your mouth are outside your body. Chemicals that are in your nose, your nasal cavities are really outside your body. So taste and smell are the result of exteroreceptors because they're not really inside your body. They haven't been absorbed. All right, so let's talk about gustation first. Oh, here's gustation right here. All right, and where can you taste? Okay, can you taste with your fingertips? No. Elbow? Kneecap, earlobe, no, only your tongue. So what kind of sense is that, general or special? That's special, all right? It's a special sense. And you have certain structures inside your tongue that we call a taste bud that allows you to taste various kinds of chemical compounds that have to dissolve in saliva, and then saliva has to enter this taste pore on the surface of your tongue, and then it's going to bind to receptors of this apparatus right here that we call a taste bud. Now, when you go home tonight and take a look at your tongue because you're curious about these taste buds, okay, and you look at your tongue and you see all kinds of bumps and little like velvety surface on the surface of your tongue, is that a taste bud? Okay, and you may or may not be able to answer that, but look at this taste bud right here, and what do we see inside this taste bud? Here I see a nucleus. So what is this thing right here? That's a cell. Can you see a cell with your naked eye? Absolutely not. And here is a taste bud that's made up of, at most, 100 cells. And that kind of thing you can't see with your naked eye. So when you look in the mirror and see all those bumps on your tongue, is that really a taste bud that you're looking at? Okay, in anatomy, we actually looked at that. But what are those things that are on the surface of your tongue that you can see? They're called papillae. Okay, and there are different kinds of papillae depending on where it is located on your tongue. But the things that you can see are not taste buds. That's kind of a common misnomer when we talk about it. So each one of those papillae have thousands of taste buds on them that have this structure right here, including this pore. Okay, so it has receptor cells that have these things that look like cilia on them, right? And it also has supporting cells. And then the taste cells themselves have a chemical synapse to this neuron, which then takes information to the gustatory center in the brain. right? And every taste bud has the ability, there's a lot of discussion on this still, I think, has the ability to taste the five major kinds of taste sensations. All right, so in terms of anatomy and space, how can we define a certain point in this room? Like, how many planes are there in anatomy that we can use to describe somebody's body? Okay, you got three. You got what? Sagittal, you got coronal, and then the third one is transverse. All right, so if we want to describe physical space, like if I wanted to point out to somebody where my Coke bottle is, what three numbers, how many numbers would I have to give somebody to tell them exactly where that Coke bottle is? Three numbers. How far away it is from the front wall or back wall, that's one number. Okay, but if it was that, what would it be? Like this whole plane right here. They couldn't find the bottle. But we could then tell them how far it is off the floor, how far away from the front wall, how far off the floor, but could they find the bottle then? No, because it could still be anywhere on a line. To describe just that one item right there, we also have to tell them what? How far away it is from the side wall. So there's three dimensions for physical space. But for taste, these are the dimensions that people use to understand what a molecule is. There's a taste of sweetness and sour, salty, bitter, and then there's one that produces satisfaction, okay, and that's called umami. Satisfaction, what's another? Deliciousness is another way of describing this particular. Savory I like. Okay? And that's due to amino acids, primarily glutamic acid. All right, so we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 basic dimensions for understanding what something tastes like. Right? And your brain can decide, depending on what kind of practice you have, of course, deciding what something is by how sweet it is, how sour, how salty, how bitter, for instance. All right, so what am I thinking right now as an example of something that I might want to consume that has some of these different components to it? Like, how about a margarita? Okay, what does a margarita have? It's got some sweet. What about salty? Yeah, it's got salty. What about sour? Yeah, okay, so by tasting these different components, your mind can make a picture of what that particular compound is. Okay, and of course some things that we eat don't have all the components, like sugar only tastes sweet, right? Saccharin tastes sweet and then sour, right? So it all depends, right? All right, so these are the dimensions of taste, and each of these dimensions right here have a particular receptor cell, and when that receptor cell becomes stimulated, it sends an action potential to the brain for you to understand what these different components are. So let's take a look at some of these cells. And you'll be probably amazed at how simple this is once we analyze it. So here we have a taste receptor cell. Here are the cilia, okay, that are poking up toward the pore of a taste bud. And in the cilia right here, for this particular taste modality of taste sensation, the cell has sodium channels that are always open. And what is sodium a component of in your food? Salt. And it says right here, salt, right? So when you eat sodium chloride, a lot of salt, and sodium chloride then dissociates into sodium ions and chloride ions, and those dissociated sodium ions then can move through this channel right here, which is a sodium channel, and it's always open. It never closes. It's not a gated channel. It's just a leak channel. And then sodium can go from saliva into the cell, and when it does, voila, what happens? That causes depolarization, which is what? An excitatory signal. Right, and so depolarization then goes down to the bottom of this cell, and that voltage change in the cell membrane causes these calcium channels to open. Remember, calcium is high on the outside of the cell. Calcium enters the cell, and then it causes release of this neurotransmitter, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter, which then sends, which develops what? Graded potentials, and if they're threshold, that develops action potentials that goes to the brain, and then you have this sensation of salt, because it goes to the salty recognition part of your cerebral cortex. All right, so that's salty. That's really simple. Sour is pretty much the same, right? Sour is the taste of acidity that's in our food. And what is pH a measure of? Okay, but in terms of molecules, in terms of real molecules, is what? Hydrogen ions, right? So when you eat a very acidic food, there's a lot of hydrogen ions. That's a cation. And here are some hydrogen ion channels, which are different in shape than the sodium ion channels right here. So when you put acetic acid on your salad and eat it, you get the sensation of that acetic acid entering the cell. And when this hydrogen ion enters the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? Because what? Hydrogen ion is a cation. It depolarizes, which is what? Inhibition or excitation? Yeah, depolarization is always excitation. When depolarization reaches these calcium channels right here, they open up because they're voltage-gated channels, and that causes release of neurotransmitter, produces generated potentials that if they reach threshold, then sends action potentials to the acidic perception part of your brain, of your gustatory cortex. All right, so salt and sour are pretty easy. They're just due to ion channels that allow for depolarization. Okay, let's look at the other three kinds of taste sensations. A little bit more complicated, but not too bad. All right, sweet and umami bind to a membrane receptor. So these compounds, like glucose, don't have to enter the cell. Right? And so since they don't enter the cell, what do we consider these signaling molecules right here? Okay, these signaling molecules that are trapped outside the cell all the time. First messengers, okay, and first messengers can produce second messengers inside the cell, and the common theme that we've seen is what a G protein coupled receptor can do that. So here is a receptor that's coupled to a G protein. When a sugar molecule or an amino acid binds to this receptor, it causes the development of another second messenger. And that second messenger could be cyclic AMP or some other kind of compound, right? That builds up inside the cell and that closes potassium channels. So second messenger bumps into these potassium channels, all right, which are normally open. If these potassium channels are normally open, what's that doing to the membrane potential of this cell if they're normally open? Where do you have high concentration of potassium? Inside, low outside. So if these are normally open, this potassium is constantly leaking outside the cell. And remember, it's a cation. So when a cation leaves the cell, what happens to the membrane potential right here? It becomes more negative, or we say hyperpolarization, right? And hyperpolarization causes, well, hyperpolarization is what? Inhibitory. But so that when the second messenger binds to these potassium channels and closes them, instead of producing hyperpolarization, it produces... What's the opposite of hyperpolarization? Because potassium can't leave. It depolarizes, right? So when the second messenger builds up, that causes depolarization of the cell because potassium can't leak out. And don't forget, depolarization is excitatory. That causes release of this neurotransmitter to produce generator potentials on this neuron, which if they reach threshold, produce action potentials. So this is the same scheme for sugar molecules and amino acids. Okay, bitter is the fifth kind of modality. All right, and bitter, I guess, ever have tonic water? Tonic water is not really sour. It has a bitter taste to it, a different kind of sensation. Sounds like you're going to have to stop at the liquor store on the way home or grocery store. Get some tonic water, right, and get some quinine because that's what's in tonic water. And it's going to bind to a receptor. This is the first messenger. This is a G protein coupled receptor right here, which causes, maybe it activates adenylate cyclase, which then takes ATP, makes cyclic AMP out of it. That will be the second messenger. Cyclic AMP then will cause calcium release from endoplasmic reticulum, like I see right here. Here's endoplasmic reticulum. One job of endoplasmic reticulum is to store calcium. But we might have to refresh our memory a little bit. What do you know about endoplasmic reticulum? How many kinds are there? There's two kinds. And they are? Smooth and rough. What does rough do? Make proteins because it has ribosomes. And smooth, what did you learn for smooth? Okay. It synthesizes lipids. And sometimes I forget if I mentioned it earlier in the class. I hope I remembered. But it also stores calcium. There are calcium pumps that pump calcium from the cytosol into the smooth ER. That's why there's so very little calcium normally inside the cytosol. Okay, so I'm glad, it sounds like I mentioned that earlier in the class. So indeed, here is a storage form for calcium in smooth ER. There is also a lot of calcium on the outside. of the cell. All right, but this second messenger activates channels that allow calcium to leave the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, which is the typical kind of signal that we know that activates that fusion and docking process and release of neurotransmitter from cells. And so that neurotransmitter is released, producing receptor potentials, which if they reach threshold, does what to the sensory neuron? It produces an action potential that can zip up this neuron and go to the brain, right? Because an action potential travels how? Without decrement. It doesn't die away. All right, so this is how those five senses are transduced. Some are by ion channels, like we see for sodium and for hydrogen ions. Some use G-protein coupled receptors, which act through second messengers inside the cell. Okay, let's go to another sense, and that is olfaction. All right, and these receptors, and what can you smell with? Fingertips, earlobe, kneecap, belly button? No, only inside your nose. And in particular, one particular region of your nose, right below the cribriform plate, right of the ethmoid bone, right on either side of the crista galli, so it's a pretty small area. You have neurons that actually go through the cribriform plate. Remember, what are all those holes called? All those holes in the olfactory foramina? Oh, no, I just told you the answer. Sorry. They're olfactory foramina. Yeah, you're right. All right, so these olfactory nerves go through the olfactory foramina into the nasal cavity. And this is the only place I'm aware of in the human body where you actually have part of your nervous system dangling outside your body in your nose. All right, and you can imagine that's a pretty rough place to hang out because there's nothing controlling the humidity, temperature, what chemicals they're exposed to, what bacteria, viruses, right, fungi, parasites, any kind of parasite have access to these little nerves right here. All right. And there's some similarity with what those receptor cells that we use for gustation because the receptor cells have cilia on them. So here I see receptor cells, and when they bind, okay, odorant molecules, then that will produce graded potentials on this bipolar cell. And remember, a bipolar cell is a sensory neuron that is exclusively for special sensation, like for instance, for olfaction and vision. And then that will send action potentials up to the olfactory bulb. And then here is a synapse, and there's some signal processing. There's sharing of information between various neurons, right? And lots of interneurons in the olfactory bulb for signal processing. And then these send action potentials to the brain for your perception of odorant molecules. Now, we also have an epithelium that these bipolar cells are embedded in. And then we also have stem cells. All right, so here is one example of the nervous system that can actually repair and reproduce itself if there is not too much damage to this epithelium right here. All right, so these are stem cells. When these guys get damaged, these can replace them. They can regenerate and replace these olfactory receptor cells, which is pretty handy. And why is that? Because everything we breathe inside our nose has, what, access to these bipolar neurons. So these neurons live for a very short period of time as a result. All right, and basal cells reproduce new receptor cells every couple months. But if you do something really nasty to your nose, okay, you might be without smell for a couple of months until they're regenerated. Unless you do something so bad that you burn this epithelium completely and you destroy the stem cells right here. Or maybe if you're continuously destroying the stem cells. What could continuously destroy the stem cells in this epithelium? Like maybe smoking or something, okay? And the other supporting cells contain enzymes that can detoxify harmful compounds that we have enter our nose. So if you really want to smell something, can you just breathe quietly down into your lungs? If you really want to smell something, what do you have to do? You really have to sniff, right? Like if you're a wine connoisseur or something, right? If you really want to smell something, you need to get those odorant molecules way up over here, okay, by the roof of the nasal cavity. Okay, in order to get those odorant molecules to bind to these receptors. All right, and the receptors for smell are all G-protein coupled receptors, but the dimensions, all right, for space, there's what, three dimensions. How many dimensions for taste? Five. All right, but for smell, there are thousands of dimensions. All right, so our ability to smell is much more accurate and precise, all right, because there's so many more dimensions, and there's so many dimensions that it's really hard to classify them. I suppose in Wikipedia, you could look at the first couple hundred and sort of make sense out of it, but it's something that I really don't want to go over in class, okay? And then all of those signals are sent to the brain, and you can kind of figure out what you're smelling. All right, so let's go to ears. And ears, can you hear with your belly button? No, you can only hear with your ears. So what kind of sense is it? It's a special sense because it requires only the ears. And what bone of the cranium has the apparatus for hearing in it? I don't think I have a picture of that. But it's right here, right? You know where your ears are. So what's the bone, right, deep to your ears? That's the temporal bone, right? And then you got the external acoustic meatus. What? Oh, yes, the external acoustic meatus. All right, and then you have an internal acoustic meatus, but it's not a patent channel that goes all the way across the temporal bone. There is a region on the interior part of the temporal bone between the external and internal acoustic meatus. Can you remember what that was called from anatomy? That's called the petrous region of the temporal bone, petrous region. Maybe see me in the anatomy study room. Okay, I can show you where that is after your lab someday. All right, so do I have anything that kind of looks, this is pretty good. All right, so here's the temporal bone, here's the external acoustic meatus, and then here's the internal acoustic meatus with some nerves leaving, some blood vessels, and so there's no way to like shine a flashlight into the external and have that light show up on the brain because you have all of this apparatus in the middle. It's what we call part of the middle ear and inner ear right here, and this is within the petrous region of the temporal bone. And this allows us to hear, but there are two other special senses that are active in this area. The first one that involves this structure here that looks like a snail, that's the cochlea, that's for hearing. Okay? So there's a little bony labyrinth right here making this cochlea, that's for hearing. And the other two senses are involved with this apparatus right here, which is also in the inner part of the ear. Kind of doesn't look like it, but both of these. All right, this is what we call the vestibular apparatus. It's made up of the vestibule and these semicircular canals. And these things give you a sense of body position and also what your body's doing. Okay? What is it, accelerating, or is it twirling or twisting, or is it stationary? Okay, so this is what gives you a sense of equilibrium, and the two senses of equilibrium are what we call static and dynamic. These are two different ways of talking about it. So let's talk about equilibrium first, which is right here. All right, so equilibrium pretty much is the sense that orients you to gravity. And the vestibular apparatus right here, we said, was in the inner ear, and it has some organs in these locations. Right, and so the utricle and saccule are right here, is loaded with nerves, and these are the organs inside the utricle and saccule are what we call the maculae. So let's see if I can show you what a maculae looks like. Well, first maybe some common themes. All right, common themes with the semicircular canals and the utricle and saccule. There is fluid, right, inside of a membrane inside the cochlea and the vestibule and semicircular canal. So the cochlea is the bony labyrinth. There's also a membranous labyrinth. There is fluid that fills that inner cavity, right, that we call endolymph. Right, and that fluid can flow through these various chambers right here, but it also floats and suspends these different components for hearing and equilibrium. All right, so this slide also shows what? That you have three semicircular canals, and that represents, or that relates to, how many dimensions in space? Yeah, because we have three dimensions in space, and these semicircular canals are oriented, but sagittal plane, coronal plane, plane or transverse plane. Okay, so let's look at the utricle and saccule. For linear acceleration or linear acceleration for utricle and saccule, another name for linear acceleration is static equilibrium. And the semicircular canals will give us the sense of angular acceleration. And I guess another good way of talking about angular acceleration is what? Spinning or twirling is angular. Linear acceleration is when you just go in a straight line back and forth. All right, but what acceleration is in particular, all right, is when you change your speed. So you actually have to be increasing your speed or decreasing your speed in order for these receptors to become sensitive to it. So right now, are you changing your speed? You're not accelerating. All right, you get in your car and you get on the 405 freeway and you hit the accelerator and you get to 55 miles an hour and you stay exactly at 55 miles an hour for the next half hour. So for that half hour, are you accelerating? You're not, because you're going the same speed. All right. So these accelerators or these accelerometers in the utricle and saccule will only sense when you speed up as you're getting on the freeway or when you slow down. That's when they will give you information. The other interesting thing is that gravity works like acceleration in your body. All right, so when you get in the car and you accelerate and your back is up against the seat and you accelerate, you notice a difference in pressure on your back. Say you really punch the accelerator. What is your back feel? Like it's being thrown into the back of the chair because you are what? Accelerating. And as you reach 55 miles an hour, what happens to that pressure on your back? You stop accelerating and then there's really not much pressure left on your back because you're not accelerating. All right. So right now you're sitting down, but think of maybe you're standing up like I am right now. All right. I can feel pressure on my feet because why is that? Because gravity, even though I'm not moving, gravity acts on me like it is an acceleration force. You don't feel it on your feet. You feel it where? On your buttocks. Right? You feel that pressure. All right? That's because gravity is accelerating you in that particular direction. Kind of a weird concept, but that's what gravity does. All right, so gravity produces this linear acceleration on us all the time. And it's the utricle and saccule that can sense that. And the way that it does is that there are special cells inside the maculae that have cilia on them. All right, so here we have some stereocilia. They kind of look like cilia on top of this nice columnar cell. And they're connected on one side to a larger cilium that we call the kinocilium. All right, so here are some junctions between them. And when these cilia are bent one way or the other, they can open and close ion channels in the cell membrane, sodium and potassium channels. So for instance, when they bend to the right, sodium channels close. All right, so what happens to, okay, what happens to the cell membrane when sodium channels close? If sodium channels open, that's excitatory. If sodium channels close, that's inhibitory. So that produces very few action potentials. If these stereocilia are bent in the opposite directions, it opens sodium channels. And then what happens? That's an excitatory signal that causes depolarization. That increases the frequency of action potentials to the brain. Okay, so if the stereocilia move in this direction, you get the sense of decelerating. If they move in the opposite direction, you get the sense of accelerating, increasing your velocity with respect to gravity. All right, so here is a nice illustration of a maculae that we have in the utricle and saccule. And I see some nerve fibers right here. They're connecting to these cells that have the stereocilia on them. And because they have all these stereocilia, somebody called these hair cells. These cells really don't produce hair. They just kind of look like they have hair on them at this microscopic level. All right, and these stereocilia poke up into a gelatinous mass right here, like a jelly-like material. And embedded in that jelly-like material are what we call otoliths. All right, and what does oto mean?
Ear.
All right, so they're in your ear. right? And these are calcium carbonate crystals. So these are like little crystals or little rocks embedded in the gelatinous mass. So that adds weight to the gelatin. And what can you tell me about gravity? Does it push weight away or does it pull weight down? It's pulling weight down, right? So that's what these otoliths are. So when your head is straight up like this, these little weights are pushing straight down on the stereocilia, and they're strong enough so that they don't bend. Right? But as soon as you tilt your head forward like this, that gelatinous mass kind of starts to sag because these otoliths are pulling on it. And when it starts to sag, it deforms these stereocilia, changing the electrical properties of the cell, depending on which way you bend your head back and forth. Okay, and if it depolarizes the cell, that increases action potentials to the brain, right? If your head is tilted the other way, then that decreases action potentials going to the brain. All right, so that's what these otoliths are for. Okay, they just bend these stereocilia depending on what position your head is in. All right, and so these are the maculae in the utricle and saccule, so you don't have to be changing. You don't have to be physically accelerating, changing your body position, just changing the position of your head, because gravity acts like acceleration. And we have this in the vestibule, which is, where are these located? Right here and right here. And this gelatin is just floating within the endolymph inside the membranous labyrinth. Okay, next slide. These areas right here. Here are the semicircular canals. There's a little bulge at the base of each of the semicircular canals, just like in the vestibule, these little bulges. I didn't tell you what the name of that organ is. The name of this organ right here is, oh yeah, I did. It's the maculae. Okay, so these are maculae inside the utricle and saccule. Here's a similar kind of organ. 1, 2, 3 for each of the semicircular canals. But these organs are what we call the crista ampullaris, or one is a crista ampullaris, right? And let's see if we got a slide. Here's a crista ampullaris. So this little bulge right here is an ampule. What's an ampule? Sometimes we carry medicine in a little glass vial, okay, which is an ampule, and somebody looked at these semicircular canals, it looked like a tiny little vial right here, filled with something, so they call it an ampule. And it also has some cristae inside there, so they call it the crista ampullaris. And then here is really the crista ampullaris. So inside the vial, there is fluid, and that fluid has a special arrangement because it can flow in a circle all the way around, okay? And it can flow in a vertical circle or a horizontal circle in the transverse plane, okay, or the coronal plane. It can actually flow in a circle. And when it does, it's going to bump up against to this cell right here. So here is another hair cell with stereocilia. And the stereocilia go up and attach to the other part, the opposite side of the membranous labyrinth. And there's endolymph in here that can flow in a circle. But if you're sitting stationary for a long period of time, there's no flow in that fluid, right? Because there's nothing causing it to move. There's no pumps or anything. And this crista ampullaris is stationary. These stereocilia aren't bent at all, so you don't have any sense that you're spinning. The crista ampullaris is connected very tightly to the semicircular canals, which are glued right into the petrous region of the temporal bone. So if your temporal bone isn't moving, neither is this crista ampullaris. But as soon as you start to spin in one of these directions, right, like this direction or head over heels, okay, then the crista ampullaris moves, but the fluid here has a tendency not to move. That physical property of mass is what we call inertia. So inertia just means that if you have mass and you're not moving, you like to stay stationary. The other property of inertia is that once you get into motion, right, and that force is taken away that got you into motion, then mass likes to continue in that particular direction. So inertia has those two features to it. Okay, and it's due to the mass. I need a piece of paper. Good. So if something has mass, like that endolymph right there, Okay, it has inertia. So here I have a Coke bottle, and it's got fluid in there. We could consider that endolymph for our purposes. All right, and right now it's stationary. All right, it's stationary. So because of inertia, if I try to move it, what does it want to do? It wants to stay right there because of inertia. And so let's see what's happening. Spring break. Oh, you might have a big party at your house later on in a couple weeks. Have a bunch of people over, right? So you could set the table with candelabra, wine glasses, and everything, and you could do this little experiment. And you could tell everybody, you know, I'm going to remove the tablecloth without affecting any of the silverware, plates, wine glasses, or anything. Right, because all those silverware, plates, wine glasses, wine bottle, champagne, whatever you might have, has inertia. And they're going to go, oh, wow, yeah, maybe you're right, show me. So you take the tablecloth and go just like that. So you move the tablecloth, but endolymph in your ear doesn't move because why? It has inertia. It just does not want to move, right? So if you start moving, so this piece of paper right here is the crista ampullaris. When you start to twist your head, move your head, we're moving the paper. The paper is moving, but what about the endolymph inside your ear? It stays stationary. All right, so let's take a look at this. So when you start to move, the endolymph is stationary, so the crista ampullaris is moving through the fluid, and when it moves through the fluid that's moving, it's going to bend the stereocilia in one direction. Okay? So the fluid isn't moving, but this guy's head is moving, so of course the crista ampullaris is moving, and that's going to bend the stereocilia, which then will give you the sense that you are beginning to spin in one particular direction. Okay. And then maybe even you did this last night. If you stay in one position and you start twirling and spinning for a long period of time, like maybe 10 or 15 seconds, okay, and then stop and open your eyes, what do you see? What do you feel? You feel like you're spinning and actually in the opposite direction that you were actually spinning in. And why is that? And that has to do with inertia once again. Okay, so here we have the endolymph inside the ear. Here's your crista ampullaris. Okay, so don't forget, this is the fluid part inside the ear, which is what, these arrows right here. So you start to spin and you get a sense of spinning and you do it for a long period of time. What happens if we pull this piece of paper for a long period of time? It's going to drag the endolymph with it. It's going to start moving at the same velocity. And then we're going to stop the crista ampullaris really fast. What's still going to happen to the endolymph? It's going to continue moving and push the stereocilia the other way. So let's do that. Not bad. Probably could do it a little bit better. Okay, do it really, really fast. And the endolymph tip keeps moving and it bends the stereocilia the other way. And that sends action potentials to the brain, giving you the sense that you're twirling in the opposite direction. All right, so that's the crista ampullaris right here. And these things are called hair cells. Where else did we see hair cells? Not just in the crista ampullaris, but the maculae as well. Okay, so hair cells are kind of fancy ways that can measure mechanical deformation and change that signal into action potentials that go to the brain, which then your brain can perceive as various kinds of signals, depending on what part of the brain it goes to, linear acceleration or angular acceleration. All right, so let's, I'm going to give you a cheat sheet on this. It might be in Blackboard. I don't want to pull it up right now. But what is, and on that sheet it's going to say what the sense of linear acceleration is. You should jot that down in your book. Linear acceleration is the same as static equilibrium and angular acceleration, as opposed to linear acceleration, is what we call kinetic equilibrium. All right, they're two different senses by two different organs, but where do we find these organs for equilibrium, both static and kinetic? In your inner ear, right? So it's part of your inner ear. But there's something else you can appreciate with your ear, which is?
Sound.
Yeah, sound, okay? Which is the last part of the ear. So there's three special senses in the ear. All right, so sound is produced by waves, pressure waves, that oscillate between high pressure and low pressure, right? And waves are characterized by the frequency and intensity, My frequency is measured in hertz, so I could put a couple waves on the board right here. All right, so, and here's another wave right here. So the top one is low frequency. So there's a large difference in time between the peaks of the waves. This is high frequency because this period of time is a lot shorter for high frequency. Okay, the amplitude is measured from the midpoint up to the peak of the wave. That's the amplitude. All right, so what can you tell? So here is wave A, and then here is wave B. Oh man, that's a really lousy diagram. Hold on. Here's wave B. So here's B. What can you tell me about the frequency of A and B? The frequency is exactly the same, but what is there something different about them? The amplitude. Yeah, the amplitude, because, all right, so this is a higher frequency, same amplitude as this one. B is just lower amplitude, same frequency. And your ears can identify those two different aspects of sound waves, right? So intensity is directly related to the amplitude of a wave. We measure it in something we call decibels. Sometimes we do this in lab. All right, so we're going to start right here next time. So review all your anatomy of the ear, including the outer ear, middle ear, and inner ear for next time.